It was with what seemed an air of callousness.
You will soon see. I will take you there.
But such a thing has never happened before.
Simon did not pursue this cryptic last remark. Instead, he asked, But where are you taking me?
To my brother, as he asked me to,
Aditu said. She looked solemn, but a wild light gleamed in her eyes.
To the home of our people, Xiao-i-Tonake.
Simon finished chewing and swallowed. I will go anywhere there is a fire. Chapter 21 Prince of Grass.
See nothing, Hotfig murmured, but look to the red coat there by the fence.
Deonoth followed the thriving man's subtle gesture until his gaze lit on a roan stallion. The horse regarded Deonoth warily, stepping from side to side as though he might bolt at any moment.
Ah, yes, Deonoth nodded his head. He is a proud one.
He turned.
Did you see this one, my prince?
Joshua, who was leaning against the gate at the far side of the paddock, waved his hand. The prince's head was wrapped in linen bandages, and he moved as slowly as if all of his bones were broken. But he had insisted on coming out to assist in claiming the fruits of his wager. Fekolmij, apoplectic with rage at the idea of watching Joshua picking 13 thriving horses from the March Thane's own pens, had sent his Randwater Hotvig in his place. Instead of mirroring his Thane's attitude, Hotvig seemed rather taken with the visitors, and with Prince Joshua in particular. On the grasslands, a one-handed man did not often kill an opponent half again his size.
What's the Red's name?
Joshua asked for Colmage's horsekeeper, a wiry ancient man with a tiny wisp of hair on the top of his head.
Vinyafod,
this one said shortly, then turned his back.
It means Windfoot, Prince Joshua,
Hotvig pronounced the title awkwardly. The Rand Warder went and slipped a rope about the stallion's neck, then led the bulking animal to the prince. Joshua smiled as he looked the horse up and down, then boldly reached up and pulled at its lower lip, exposing the teeth. The stallion shook his head and pulled away, but Joshua grabbed the lip again. After a few nervous headshakes, the horse at last allowed himself to be examined, the only sign of anxiety his blinking eyes.
Well, he is certainly one we shall take east with us, Joshua said, although I doubt that will please Fekolmij.
It will not, Hotvig said solemnly.
If his honor was not held up before all the clans, he would kill you just for coming near these horses. This Vinyafod was one that Fekolmij demanded specially as part of Blaemon's booty when Fekolmij became leader of the clans.
Joshua nodded solemnly.
I don't want the March Thane so angry that he follows and murders us, pledge or no pledge. Deonoth, I give you leave to pick the rest. I trust your eye better than mine. We will take Vinyafod, that is certain. As a matter of fact, I think I will claim him for my own. I am tired of limping from here to there. But as I said, let us not cull the herd so thoroughly that we force Fekolmij to dishonor himself.
I will choose carefully, sire.
Deonoth strode across the paddock. The horsekeeper saw him coming and tried to sidle away, but Deonoth hooked the old man's elbow and began asking questions. The keeper was hard-pressed to pretend he could not understand. Joshua watched with a faint smile on his face, shifting his balance from one foot to another to spare his aching body. Hotvig watched the prince from the corner of his eye for a long time before he spoke.
You said you go east, Joshua? Why?
The prince looked at him curiously.
There are many reasons, some of which I cannot discuss. But mostly, it is because I must find a place to make a stand against my brother and the evil that he has done.
Hotvig nodded his head with exaggerated seriousness.
It seems that you have kinsmen who feel as you do.
Joshua's expression turned to puzzlement.
What do you mean?
There are others of your kind
other stone dwellers, who have begun to settle east of here. That is why Fekalmage brought us so far north of our usual grazing areas for this season, to make sure that the newcomers were not crossing onto our lands.
A grin crossed Hodvig's scarred face.
There were other reasons for our clan coming here, too. The March Thane of the Meadow Thrithings tried to steal away some of our Rand Waters at the last gathering of clans. So Fekalmage wanted his people far away from the Meadow Thrithings. Fekalmage is feared, but not well-loved. Many wagons have already left the Stallion clan.
Joshua waved impatiently. The bickering between the Thrithings clans was legendary.
What about the stone dwellers you spoke of? Who are they?
Hartvig shrugged and fingered his braided beard.
Who can say? They came from the west, whole families, some traveling in carts as our people do, some on foot. But they were not our people, not Thrithings men. We heard of them from our outriders when we were at the second to last gathering. But they passed through the north of the High Thrithings and were gone.
How many?
Again the Thrithings man shrugged.
Stories say as many as in two or three of our small clans.
So, perhaps 100 or 2. The prince seemed to momentarily escape his pain, for his face brightened as he pondered this news.
But that is not all, Prince Joshua,
Hotfix said earnestly.
That was one group. Other companies have trickled past since then. I have myself seen 2 hands worth or so all counted. They are poor, though. And they have no horses, so we let them pass out of our lands.
You did not let my folk pass, and we had not a pony between us.
Joshua's smile was sardonic.
That is because Fekalmage knew it was you. The Rand Warders had watched your people for several days.
Deonoth approached, the grumbling horsekeeper in tow.
I have chosen, Highness. Let me show you.
He pointed to a long-legged bay.
Since you have picked Red Vinyafod for your own, Prince Joshua, I have selected this one for myself. Vildelix is his name. Wildshine.
He is splendid, Joshua said, laughing.
You see, Deonoth, I remembered what you said about Thrithing's horses. Now you have some, just as you asked.
Deonoth looked at Joshua's bandages.
The price was too high, sire.
His eyes were sorrowful.
Show me the rest of our new herd, said Joshua.
Vosheva came out to meet the prince as he and the others returned from the paddock. Hodvig took one look at her face and slipped away.
You are foolish to be up walking.
The Thane's daughter turned to Deonoth.
How could you keep him out so long? He is very unwell.
Deonoth said nothing, but only bowed. Joshua smiled.
Peace, lady, the prince said.
The fault is not Sir Deonoth's. I wanted to see the horses, since I am most assuredly going to ride, and not walk from here.
He chuckled ruefully.
Not that I could walk more than a furlong these days in any case, even if my life were in the balance. But I will get stronger.
Not if you stand in the cold?
Vosheva leveled her sharp-eyed glance at Deonoth, as if daring him to argue. She took Joshua's arm, adjusting her pace to his halting strides, and together all three went back toward the camp. The prince's company was still housed in the bull run. Fekalmage had snarled that just because he had lost a wager was no reason that he must treat miserable stone dwellers like clansmen. But several of the more high-minded Thrithings folk had brought blankets and ropes and tent stakes. Fekalmage was not a king. While the people lending assistance to the former prisoners gave the March Thane's camp a wide berth, neither were they ashamed or afraid to go against his wishes. Led by practical Duchess Gutrun, Joshua's people had quickly made of these contributions a secure shelter, closed on 3 sides and double-roofed with blankets of heavy wool. This served to keep out the worst of the cold rains, which seemed to increase in strength daily. Above the Thrivings, the grey-black sky hung threateningly close, as though the very grasslands had been lifted up by giant hands. This spell of bad weather, which had lasted nearly a week straight, and off and on for over a month, would have been unusual even in early spring. It was now high summer, however, and the people of the Stallion Clan were openly worried. "Come, my lady," Joshua said as they reached the enclosure. "Let you and I walk a little while longer."
"You should not walk more," Forshava said indignantly. "Not with your wounds. You must sit and have some hot wine."
"Nevertheless," Joshua said firmly.
"Want your careful thinking, your measuring, your talking, talking, talking."
An angry tear was quickly wiped away.
"Just give your heart, you damned stone dweller."
They stopped, standing in wind-rippled grass to their knees.
"I try," he said.
"No, you do not,"
she hissed bitterly.
"You have that other woman's face in your heart, your brother's wife. Men, you are all little boys. You keep old loves in your heart like polished stones you have found. How can I fight a dead woman? I cannot grab her. I cannot slap her. I cannot drive her away or follow you when you go to her."
She stood breathing heavily, her legs wide set as though braced for battle. Her hands dropped to her stomach and her look changed.
"But you did not give her a child. You gave one to me."
Joshua looked helplessly at her pale face, at the rosy flush of her cheeks and her cloud of black hair. A movement caught his eye. A rabbit emerging from a thatch of tall grass stopped for a moment and rose on its hindquarters to look around. Its dark round eye touched his. A moment later it sprang forward and was gone, a thin grey shadow skimming the meadow.
"You have done nothing wrong, lady," he said. "Nothing but attach yourself to a brooding ghost of a man."
He smiled sadly, then laughed. "But in a way, I suppose I have been reborn. I have been allowed to live when surely I ought to have died. So I must take that as an omen and see my life differently. You will bear our child, and we will be married when we reach the Stone of Farewell." A touch of indignation returned to Vosheva's dark eyes.
"We will be married here, before my people," she said firmly. "We are betrothed. Now they will see and stop speaking behind their hands."
"But, lady," he began, "we have need of haste."
"Have you no honor?" she demanded. "What if you are killed before we reach this place? The child in me will be a bastard, and I will not even be a widow."
Joshua began to speak, but instead broke into laughter once more. He reached his arm around her and pulled her close, unmindful of his injuries. She resisted for a moment, then allowed herself to be embraced, but retained her frown. "Lady, you are right," the prince said, smiling. "It shall not be put off. Father Strangyard will marry us, and I will be a good husband to you and keep you safe. And if I die before we reach our destination, you will be the finest widow on the grasslands." He kissed her. For a while they stood in the rain, faces pressed close together.
"You are trembling,"
Vosheva said at last, but her own voice seemed the unsteady thing. She pulled free of Joshua's embrace.
"You have stood and walked too long. If you die before we marry, it will spoil everything."
Her look was softer, but still some trace of apprehension remained, an edge of fear that would not go away. Joshua took her hand and lifted it to his lips. They turned and walked slowly back toward the encampment, as carefully as if they were both very, very old.
"I must leave," Jaloi announced that evening.
Joshua's people huddled around the fire as fierce winds strummed at the walls of their makeshift shelter.
"I hope you do not mean that," Joshua said. "We have need of your wisdom."
De Ornoth felt himself both glad and sorry at the thought of the witch-woman leaving.
"We will all meet again, and soon," she said. "But I must go ahead to the stone of farewell. Now that you are safe, there are things I must do there before you come."
"What things?" De Ornoth heard the edge of suspicion in his own voice, and was embarrassed by his lack of charity. But no one else seemed to notice.
"There will be,"
Jaloi searched for words,
"shadows there, and sounds, and faint traces like the ripples left behind when a pebble drops into a stream. It is vital that I try to read these before people come tramping around."
"And what will these things tell you?" Joshua asked. Jaloi shook her graying head.
"I do not know. Perhaps nothing. But the stone stands in a special and powerful place. It may be that there are things I can learn. We face an immortal enemy. Perhaps we can find some clue toward his defeat among the vestiges of his immortal people."
She turned to Duchess Gutrun, who cradled sleeping Leleth in her lap.
"Will you keep the child until you see me again?"
Gutrun nodded.
"Of course."
"Why do you not take her with you?" De Ornoth asked. "You said she helped to center your skills in some way."
Firelight glinted in Jaloi's great eyes.
"True, but she cannot travel in the way I must travel."
The witchwoman stood, tucking her breeches into her heavy boots.
"And I will do best traveling by night."
"But you will miss our marriage," Vosheva exclaimed. "Father Strangyard is to marry Joshua and me at morning time."
Those who had not yet heard offered congratulations. Joshua received all as calmly and graciously as if he stood again in his throne room at Naglamund. Vosheva's smiles at last dissolved into what were surely happy tears, which she cried on Gutrun's accommodating shoulder. Leleth, who had awakened and rolled out of the Duchess' lap to stare silently at the ruckus, was quickly scooped up into the thin arms of Father Strangyard.
"This is good news, Vosheva, Prince Joshua, but I cannot stay,"
Jaloi said.
"I do not think you will miss me. I am not much for entertainments or merrymaking, and I am feeling particularly pressed. I had wished to leave yesterday, but stayed to see that you actually claimed your horses."
She gestured out toward the darkness beyond the shelter, where the prince's new steed shifted and snorted in their own enclosure.
"Now I can wait no longer."
After brief private conversations with Joshua and Strangyard, and a few words whispered into Leleth's ear, words which the little girl received as impassively as if listening to the ocean's voice, echoing in a seashell, Jaloi said her brisk farewells, and strode out into the night, threadbare cloak snapping in the brisk wind. De Ornoth, who sat closest to the edge of the shelter, leaned his head out a short time later. He had heard a mournful echo sweeping down from the wind-raked sky. But when he looked up, he caught only a momentary glimpse of some shadowy, winged thing passing before the gelid moon. De Ornoth was standing his watch. They had not become so trusting of the Thrything's men that they had lost their sense when Joshua limped out to join him.
"The stars have barely swung around," De Ornoth whispered. "Look, there is the lamp, scarcely moved."
He pointed to a dim flare in the cloudy night sky.
"It is not your turn for hours, Highness. Go back to bed."
"I cannot sleep." De Ornoth was sure his smile was invisible in the darkness. "It is not uncommon to have worries and doubts on the night before a wedding, sire."
"It's not that, De Ornoth. My worries and my self-doubts, as once you so correctly pointed out, are trivial. There are larger matters to think of.
Deornoth wrapped the collar of his cloak tighter around his neck during the moment of silence. The night had grown very chill. "I am happy to be alive," Joshua said at last. "But I do feel a bit like a mouse that the cat has allowed to run into the corner. Alive, yes. But for how long? Far worse than even my brother's evil. Now the hand of the North is reaching out." He sighed. "Once I nurtured a hope that Yarnauga's tale was untrue, despite all the evidence. But the moment I saw those white faces staring up at me from before the walls of Naglamund, something within me died." "No, do not worry, good Deornoth," the prince said hastily. "I am not about to run maundering, as I know you secretly dread. I have taken your admonitions to heart." He laughed sourly. "But at the same time, I tell only the truth. There are hatreds that run through this world like blood, hot and lively. All my studies of evil with the Osirian brothers, all their learned considerations of the devil and his work, never made that so clear as one instant staring into those black eyes. The world has a dark underbelly, Deornoth. I wonder if maybe it is better not to seek after knowledge."
"But surely God put such things on the earth to test our faith, Prince Joshua," Deornoth ventured at last. "If no one ever saw evil, who would fear hell?"
"Who indeed?" The prince's tone changed. "But this is not why I came out to speak to you. Leave it to Joshua to turn any conversation into a dour and doomful one." He laughed again. This time it seemed more cheerful. "Actually, I came to ask you to stand for me when Vorshaver and I are married in the morning."
"Prince Joshua, I am honored. Gladly. I will do it gladly."
"You have been the most loyal of friends, Deornoth.
You are the best lord a man could have."
"I did not say liegeman or knight, Deornoth." Joshua spoke firmly, but with a hint of good humor in his voice. "I said friend. But do not think that standing for me is an honor bereft of responsibility. It is not." He became serious. "I have not had a splendid history of caring for those dear to me, Deornoth, my friend. You may protest, but it is a simple fact. Thus, if something happens to me, I want your word that you will look after Vorshaver and our child."
"Of course, my prince. Say it."
Then, more gently,
"Swear it to me."
"I swear, by the honor of blessed Alysia, that I will protect the welfare of Lady Vorshaver and the child she carries as if they were my own family. I will lay down my life without hesitation, if need be." Joshua clasped the knight's wrist and held it for a moment.
"Good.
Many thanks. The Lord bless you, Deornoth."
"May he bless you too, Prince Joshua."
The prince sighed. "And all the rest as well. Did you know, Deornoth, that tomorrow is the first day of Annitor? That means tomorrow is Hlafmansa. There are many absent friends to whom our blessing should go this night. Many who no doubt are far closer to the fearful face of darkness than we are." Deornoth saw the shadow beside him move abruptly as the prince made the sign of the tree. They shared a long moment of silence before Joshua spoke again. "May God bless us all and deliver us from evil." The men were up with the darkling dawn, saddling the horses and packing the supplies gained, when Joshua had traded two of his new steeds for a quantity of food and clothing. Since Leleth would ride with Duchess Gutrun, and Towser and Sangfugel would share a horse, four horses remained to carry goods. When the mounts had been readied, the men returned to the bull run. They found it surrounded by more than a few curious Thrithings folk.
"What, have you made some announcement?" Joshua demanded crossly.
Vorshaver eyed him unblinkingly. She had donned the white bride band once more.
Do you think my people would not notice you loading the horses? She snapped. Besides, what is the use of being married if it is done like thieves stealing by night?
She strutted away, the wide skirt of her wedding dress swirling. A moment later she returned, leading the wide-eyed young girl who had been waiting on for Colmage when Joshua's folk had first come as prisoners to the wagon camp.
This is Hiara, my youngest sister,
Vosheva explained.
She will be married some day, so I want her to see that it is not always frightful.
I will do my best to look like a nice person to marry, Joshua said, arching an eyebrow. Hiara stared back at him, anxious as a startled fawn. Vosheva insisted that they be married beneath the open sky, and before the eyes of her clanfolk. The wedding party made its way out from beneath the roof of blankets, Father Strangyard mumbling fretfully as he tried to remember the important sections of the marriage ceremony. He had not, of course, been able to bring a book of the Aedan from Naglamund, and had never performed a marriage before. Of the principals, he was clearly the most nervous. Young Hiara, sensing a kindred spirit, walked so close to him that she was almost between his feet, adding to the priest's discomfiture. It was not surprising to see a cheerful and curious crowd of Thriving's folk assembled along the edges of the bull run, a crowd not greatly different in mood, Deonoth reflected, than that which had come to watch Joshua be cut into slivers. It was a little disconcerting to see among them the mother and sisters of he who had failed to slice Joshua up, the late Utfart. This group of women, dressed identically in dresses and scarves of dark mourning blue, stared balefully at the emerging stone dwellers, their mouths pulled tight in uniform expressions of ill regard. If the attendance of Utfard's family was surprising, the appearance of Fikolmich on the scene was even more so. The March Thane, who had taken his foul temper and virtually gone into hiding after Joshua's victory, now came swaggering through the camp to the bull run, trailed by a handful of scarred rand warders. Although the grey dawn was not an hour past, Fikolmich's red-eyed stare had the look of drunkenness.
"By the grass thunderer," he bellowed, "surely you did not think I would let my daughter and her horse-rich husband be wedded without coming to share their happiness?"
He slapped his broad belly and guffawed.
"Go on, go on. We are waiting to see how marriages are done in the mazes of the stone dwellers."
At the sound of her father's roar, little Hiara took a step backward and looked wildly around, preparing to flee. Deonoth reached out and gently took her elbow, holding it loosely until she gathered courage to move forward and stand at Vosheva's side once more. Hopelessly rattled, Father Strangyard started the Mansa Canoeus, the prayer of joining, several times without success, each time losing his way after a few lines and stuttering to a halt like a mill wheel whose ox was bulking in the traces. Each failed attempt drew more laughter from Fikolmich and his rand warders. The archive master's already pink face grew redder and redder. At last, Joshua leaned forward and whispered in his ear,
"You are a scroll-bearer now, father, as was your friend, Yarnauga."
He spoke so quietly that none but Strangyard could hear.
"Surely a simple mansa is child's play for you, whatever the distractions."
"One eye speaks the marriage for one hand,"
Fikolmich shouted. Strangyard tugged self-consciously at his patch, then grimly nodded his head.
You are right, Prince Joshua. Forgive me. Let us continue."
Speaking each word carefully, Strangyard worked his way through the long ritual as though wading in high and treacherous waters. The March Thane and his jibing cronies shouted louder and louder, but the priest would no longer be deterred. At last, the crowd of watching Thriving's folk became restive, tiring of Fikolmich's rudeness. Every time another graceless jest echoed across the bull run, the murmur grew louder. As Strangyard neared the end of the prayer, Hotvig appeared on horseback out of the west. He was wind-blown and disheveled, as though he had ridden fast in his return to the wagon city. The rider sat dazedly surveying the scene for a moment, then swung down from the saddle and trotted to his thane's side. He spoke rapidly, then pointed back in the direction from which he had come. Fakarmidge nodded, grinning hugely, then turned and said something to the other Rand warders, which set them rocking with laughter. A look of confusion came over Hotvig's face, confusion which soon turned to anger. As Fakarmidge and the others continued to chortle over the news he had brought, the young Thrything's man strode to the fence around the bull run and waved for Isorn's attention. Hotvig spoke into Isorn's ear. The Rimmer's man's eyes widened. When Father Strangiard paused in his recital a few moments and bent to look for the bowl of water he had filled earlier and put by for this moment in the prayer, Iskrimnor's son pushed away from the fence and marched directly to Prince Joshua's side.
"Forgive me, Joshua," Isorn hissed, "but Hotvig says there are 60 armored riders coming down on the wagon camp. They are less than a league away and riding hard. The leader's coat is a falcon in scarlet and silver."
Startled, Joshua looked up.
"Fengbold, what is that horse I'm doing here?"
"Fengbold?" Deonoth echoed, astounded. It seemed a name from another age.
"Fengbold?"
A rustle of wonder went through the crowd at this odd turn to the ceremony.
"Joshua," Forshaver said tightly, "how can you talk of these things now?"
"I am truly sorry, my lady, but we have little choice." He turned to Strangyard, who stood staring, his increasingly confident rhythms again disrupted. "Go on to the final part," Joshua directed him.
What?
"The final part, man. Come, then, hurry to it. I won't have it said I left my lady unmarried against my promise, but if we stand much longer, she will be a widow before the mansa is over." He gave the priest a gentle shove.
"The end, Strangyard."
The archivist's one eye bulged.
"May the love of the ransomer, his mother Elysia, and his father, the All-Highest, bless this joining. May your lives be long and your love be longer still. You are married."
He waved his hands anxiously.
That's it. You are married, just as it says."
Joshua leaned and kissed the astonished Forshaver, then grabbed her wrist and pulled her toward the paddock gate, while Isorn hurried the rest of their party after them.
"Are you so anxious for your wedding night, Joshua?"
Fakarmidge smirked. He and his Rand warders pushed toward the gate as the crowd shouted questions at their thane.
"You seem to be in a hurry to leave."
"And you know why," Deonoth shouted at him, his palm itching on the hilt of his sword.
"You knew they were coming, didn't you? You treacherous dog!"
"Watch your tongue, little man,"
Fakarmidge growled.
"I only said I would not hinder your going. I sent word to the king's men long ago, in the hour when you first crossed over into my Thrithings."
He laughed heartily.
"So I broke no promises. But if you wish to fight my men and me before the Erkinlanders get here, come ahead. Otherwise, you had better get on your new ponies and ride away."
Forshaver pulled away from Joshua as they passed through the gate and into the crush of Thrithing's folk. She reached her father in a few steps and slapped him stingingly across the face.
"You killed my mother," she shouted, "but someday I will kill you."
Before he could grab her, she sprang back to Joshua's side. Nadel whisked out of the prince's sheath and swayed menacingly, a flickering tongue of light beneath the dim sky. Fakarmidge stared at Joshua, eyes bulging, face crimson with rage. With a visible effort, the March Thane subdued his anger and contemptuously turned his back.
"Go, ride for your lives," he growled. "I do not break my word over a woman's feeble blows."
Hotvig followed as they hustled toward the paddock where the horses were waiting.
"The thane was right about one thing, Joshua, Varshaver," he called. "You must indeed ride for your lives. They have an hour's start, and your horses are rested, so all is not lost. Some of the others will help me slow them down."
Deonoth stared. You'll... But Fikarmidge wants us caught. Hartvig shook his head roughly.
Not all favor the Marchthane. Where do you go?
Joshua thought for a moment.
Please do not let our enemies hear of this, Hartvig.
He lowered his voice a little.
We go north of where the rivers meet, to a place called the Stone of Farewell.
The Thrivings man looked at him strangely.
I have heard something of it, he said. Go swiftly, then. It is possible we will see each other again.
Hartvig turned and gave Vosheva a long look, then bowed his head briefly.
Make these people know that not all Thrivings folk are like your father.
Hartvig turned and walked away.
No more time to talk, Joshua cried. To horse!
The outermost grazing lands of the wagon camp were disappearing behind them. Despite the injured and inexperienced riders, the long strides of Vinyafod and his fellows ate up the ground. The grass flew away beneath their hooves.
This is becoming sickeningly familiar, Joshua shouted across to Deonoth and Isorn. What? Running, pursued by superior forces.
Joshua waved his arm.
I'm tired of showing my backside, whether to my brother or the Storm King's minions.
Deonoth looked up at the clotted sky, then over his shoulder. Only a few lone cows dotted the rearward horizon. There was no sign of pursuing riders.
We must find a place to make our stronghold, Prince Joshua, he called. That's right, Isorn shouted. People will come flocking to your banner then. You'll see.
And how will they find us? Joshua called back with a mocking smile. These people, how will they find us?
They will somehow, Isorn shouted. Everybody else does.
He whooped with laughter. The prince and Deonoth joined in. Vosheva and the others stared at them as if they were mad.
Ride on, Joshua cried. I am married and an outlaw.
The sun made no clear appearance all day. When the dim light at last began to wane and the pall of approaching evening spread across the stormy sky, the prince's party chose a spot and made camp. They had ridden due north from the wagon city until they reached the Imstrecker in early afternoon, crossing the river at a muddy ford whose banks were pockmarked with hoofprints. Joshua had decided that travelling eastward would be safer on the far side of the Imstrecker, where they would be within an hour's swift ride to the forest. If Fengbold continued to pursue them, they would at least have a chance to spur toward the dark trees and perhaps evade the superior force in Aldeota's tangled depths. Despite this caution, there had been no sign of the High King's horsemen all afternoon. The night's watches also passed uneventfully. After breaking their fast at sunrise on dried meat and bread, they were mounted and on their way. They kept their pace swift, but fear of pursuit was lessening by the hour. If Hartvig and others had done something to slow Fengbald, they seemed to have made a good job of it. The only real misfortune was the suffering of those who were unaccustomed to riding on horseback. The cold grey morning was full of regretful noises as they rode on into the east. On the second day's journey across the green but comfortless land, the travellers began to see large roofed wagons and blowsy cottages of mud and sticks dotted along the Imstrecker's banks. In two or three places, a few huts had even grown together in a tiny settlement, like slow-moving beasts seeking each other's company upon the dark plain. The chill grasslands were thick with mist, and the travellers could not see far or clearly. But the inhabitants of these huddling spots did not seem to be Thrivings folk.
Hartvig spoke aright, Joshua mused as they passed by one such settlement.
A handful of dim figures bobbed in the grey ribbon of the Imstrecker that wound beside the huts, settlers casting their fish nets.
I think they are Erkinlanders. See, that cottage has a holy tree painted on its side. But why are they here? Our folk have never lived in this land.
Upheaval, crops ruined, Strangyard said.
Goodness, how people must be suffering in Urchester. Terrible.
They are more likely God-fearing folk who know Elias deals with devils, Gutrun said.
She clasped Leleth tighter against her considerable bosom, as though to protect the child from the High King's communicants.
Should we not tell them who you are, sire?
Deonoth asked.
There is safety in numbers, and we have been few for very long. Besides, if they are Erkinlanders, you are their rightful prince.
Joshua gazed at the distant camp, then shook his head.
They may have come out here to escape all princes, rightful or otherwise. Also, if we are followed, why put innocents in danger by giving them knowledge of our names and destination? No.
As you said, when we have a stronghold, we will make ourselves known. They can then come to us if they wish, and not because we have swept down on them with swords and horses.
Deonoth kept his expression carefully neutral. But inside he was disappointed. They were in dire need of allies. Why did Joshua insist on being so damnably careful and correct?
Some things about his prince, it was obvious, would never change.
As the riders continued across the brooding steppe, the weather grew steadily worse, as though they were abroad at the turning of winter instead of the earliest days of Anatol month in what should be high summer. Flurries of snow came riding on the back of the north wind, and the impossibly broad sky had gone a perpetual grey, dreary as fireplace ash. Even as the landscape on either side grew more dismal and uninviting, the travellers began to encounter larger settlements along the Imstrecker's banks, settlements that seemed not to have grown so much as accumulated, as the river carried brambles and sticks and silt before slamming them off at convenient sandbars. So the very substance of these settlements, both people and materials, seemed to have arrived in this strange and only slightly hospitable place by chance, lodging as in some narrow spot, while the force that had carried them so far swept on without them. Joshua's people rode silently past these tiny, ramshackle hamlets, embryonic towns almost as forbidding as the land itself. Each made up of perhaps a dozen crude shelters. Few living things could be seen outside the flimsy walls, but wisps of smoke from their cooking fires twined on the wind. A second, third, and fourth night between the cloud-hidden stars took the prince's exiles to the edge of the Steflod River Valley. The evening of the fifth day brought more snow and bitter cold, but the darkness also gleamed with lights. Torches and campfires, hundreds of fires that filled the neck of the valley like a bowl of gems. The travellers had found the largest settlement yet, a near city of flimsy shelters nestled in the trough of the shallow valley where the Imstrecker and the Steflod came together. After a long journey across the empty plain, it was a heartening sight.
Still, we go like thieves, Prince Joshua, Deonoth whispered crossly. You are the son of Prester John, my lord. Why must we skulk into this crofter's clutter, acting and looking like footpads?
Joshua smiled. He had not changed his travel-stained thriving's clothes, although one of the things he had bartered for had been extra garments.
You are no longer begging my pardon for your forwardness as you once did, Deonoth. No, do not apologize. We have been through too much together for me to disapprove. You are right. We are not coming down into this place as a prince and his court. We make a sorry court in any case. We shall instead find out what we can, and not put our women and young Leleth and the rest in any unnecessary danger.
He turned to Isorn, who was the third and to this point quietest member of the trio.
If anything, we will want to allay suspicion that we are anything but ordinary travellers. You, Isorn, look especially well-fed. Your size alone might make some of these poor folk afraid.
He chuckled and poked the brawny young Rimmer's man in the side. Isorn, taken unawares by the prince's sudden light-heartedness, stumbled and almost fell.
I cannot make myself small, Joshua, he grunted. Be thankful I am not as big as my father, or your poor folk might run screaming into the night at the sight of me.
Ah, how I miss Iskrimnor, Joshua said.
May the Aiden indeed look after your father,
that good man, and bring him back to us safely. My mother misses him very much, and fears for him, Isorn said quietly, but she does not say so. His good-natured face was solemn. Joshua looked at him keenly. Yes, your family is not one for breast-beating. All the same, Deonoth suddenly said, the Duke can certainly make a ruckus when he is displeased. I remember when he first found out that Scarly was coming to King John's funeral. He threw a chair through Bishop de Mitis' screen and broke it to bits. Ouch, damn me! Laughing, Deonoth tripped on a hummock in the darkness. Tonight's misted moon was stinting with her light. Hold the torch closer, Isorn. Why are we walking and leading our horses in any case? Because if you break a leg, you can ride, the prince said dryly. If your new Mount Vildelix breaks his, will you carry him? Deonoth granted the point grudgingly. Talking quietly of Isorn's father and his legendary temper, the expression of which was almost always followed, as soon as the Duke calmed down, by horrified apologies, they made their way down the grassy slope and toward the lights of the nearest fires. The rest of their party had built camp at the valley's edge. The fire Duchess Gutrun tended was a shrinking beacon on the high ground behind them. A gang of shivering, starveling dogs barked and scattered as the threesome approached the settlement. A few shadowy figures looked up from their fires or stood cross-armed in the door flaps of shabby huts, watching the strangers pass. But if there was any sense that Joshua and his comrades did not belong, no one challenged them. From the snippets of speech they picked up as they passed, it was clear that these settlers were indeed mostly Erkinlanders, speaking both the old country speech and Westerling. Here and there, a Hernisteri burr could be heard as well. A woman stood in the open space between two houses, talking to her neighbor about the rabbit her son had brought home, and how they had steamed it with sourgrass for Hlafmansa. It was odd, Deonoth thought, to hear people speaking of such mundane things here in the midst of the empty grassland. As if there might be a church hidden behind a rock where they would go for the morning prayer, or an ostler's shop under a leaf where they could buy beer to drink with their rabbit stew. The woman, of middle years, red-faced and raw-boned, turned at their approach, and surveyed them with a look of mixed apprehension and interest. Deonoth and Isorn stepped to one side to pass around her, but Joshua halted. "We wish you a pleasant evening, good wife," the prince said, inclining his head in a sort of bow. Do you know where we could get a bit of food? We are travellers and have good money to pay. Has someone got something to sell? The woman looked him over carefully, then turned an eye on his companions. There are no taverns and no inns here, she said grimly. Everyone keeps what they have. Joshua nodded slowly, as if sifting particles of purest golden wisdom from her discourse. And what is the name of this place? He asked. It is not on any map.
Shouldn't think so, she snorted. Wasn't here 2 summers ago. It doesn't have a name, not truly. But some call it Gadrinset.
Gadrinset, Joshua repeated. Gathering place.
Not that anyone's gathering for anything. She made a face. Just can't go any farther.
And why is that? Joshua asked.
The woman ignored this last question, looking the prince up and down once more in a calculating manner.
Here, she said at last, if you want food and you'll pay for it, I might be able to do something for you. Show me your money first.
Joshua showed her a handful of kintis and kinnis pieces that he had brought in his purse out of Naglamund. The woman shook her head.
Can't take the bronze. Some folk farther along the river might trade for the silver. So I'll take a chance on one of them. Do you have aught else to trade? Leather straps from broken saddle, buckles, extra clothes?
She looked at Joshua's outfit and smirked.
No. I doubt you've got extra clothes. Come on, then, I'll give you some soup, and you can tell me any news.
She waved to her friend, who had remained at a safe distance, watching the whole exchange open-mouthed, then led them back through the cluster of huts. The woman's name was Yelda, and although she mentioned several times that her man might return at any moment, Deonoth guessed that this was mostly to forestall any thoughts of robbery that three strangers might have. He saw no sign of any living husband around her camp, which centered around an outdoor fire and small rickety cottage. She did have several children, their genders somewhat blurred by dirt and evening darkness. These came out to watch the prince and his friends with the same wide-eyed attention they might have given to a snake swallowing a frog. After receiving a Kinnis piece, which immediately vanished into her dress, Yelda poured them each a bowl of thin soup, then procured from somewhere a jar of beer that she said her man had brought with him from Falshire, where they had previously lived. Seeing that jar hardened in Deonoth's mind, the notion that her husband was dead. What man could live in this godforsaken hole, yet leave beer so long undrunk? Joshua thanked her gravely. The three of them passed the jar around several times, before thinking to ask Yelda if she would like some herself. She accepted with a gracious nod, and took several healthy swallows. Her children discussed this among themselves in a strange pidgin language consisting mostly of grunts, a few recognizable words, and repeated cuffings to the head and shoulders. The pleasures of company and conversation soon began to work on Yelda. Reserved at first, before long she was holding forth quite knowledgeably on everything there was to know about Gadrin Set and her fellow squatters. Untutored, she nevertheless had a sly wit. And although the travellers were chiefly interested in finding the way to their destination, Jaloa's instructions had not been very precise. They found themselves enjoying Yelda's imitations of her various neighbours. Like many of Gadrin Set's other inhabitants, Yelda and her family had fled Falshire when Fengbald and the Erkingard had burned down the city's wool district, a punishment for the resistance of the Wool Merchants Guild to one of Elias' less popular proclamations. Yelda also explained that Gadrin Set was even larger than Joshua's folk had first guessed. It continued for a way down the valley, she said, but the hills loomed high enough that the campfires at the far end were blocked from view. The reason it was the stopping place for so many, Yelda said, was that the land beyond the spot where the Steflod and Imstrecker joined was ill-omened and dangerous.
Full of fairy rings it is, she said earnestly, and there are mounds where spirits dance at night. That's why those folk that live in the Thrivings leave us in peace. They wouldn't live here anyway.
Her voice dropped and her eyes grew large.
One great hill there is, where witches meet, full of terrible warlock stones, worse even than Thistleborg by Urchester, if you've heard tell of that evil place. Not far from it is a city, where devils once lived, an unholy, unnatural city. Terrible magics is what that land across the river's full of. Some women here have had children stolen away. One had a changeling left in return, pointed ears and all.
That Warlock Hill sounds a fearsome place indeed, Joshua said, an expression of great seriousness on his long face. When the woman looked down at her lap, where she was mixing flour and water in a bowl, he caught Deonoth's gaze and winked.
Where is it? Yelda pointed into the darkness. Straight that way, up the Steflod. You're wise to avoid it.
She stopped, frowning.
And where are you going, sirs?
Deonoth chimed in before Joshua could speak.
Actually, we are travelling knights who hope to lend our swords to a grand task. We have heard that Prince Joshua, the younger son of High King John the Presbyter, has come here into the eastern lands, where he plots the overthrow of his wicked brother King Elias.
Trying not to smile, Deonoth ignored Joshua's irritated gestures.
We have come to join that noble cause.
The elder, who had stopped kneading the dough for a moment to stare, made a snorting noise and resumed her labor.
Prince Joshua? Hare on the grasslands? That's a clever joke. Not that I wouldn't like to see something done. Things just haven't been right since old Prester John died. Bless him.
She made a stern face. But her eyes suddenly gleamed wetly.
It's been hard for us all. So hard.
She stood abruptly and laid out the flattened balls of dough on a clean heated stone at the edge of the fire. They began to quietly sizzle.
I'm just going to see my friend, the elder said, and find out if she has a bit more beer we can borrow. I won't tell her what you said about the prince, because she'd just laugh. Watch those cakes close now, while I go. They're for the children to eat in the morning.
She got up and walked out of the circle of firelight, dabbing at her eyes with a dirty shawl.
What kind of foolishness is this, Deonoth? Joshua asked crossly. But did you hear? People like this are waiting for you to do something. You are their prince.
It seemed so obvious. Surely Joshua could see.
Prince of what? Prince of ruins? Prince of empty lands and grass? I have nothing to offer these folk. Yet.
He got up and walked to the edge of the camp. The elder's children peered out at him, a cluster of white-rimmed eyes gleaming in the darkened doorway.
But how will you gain anything without folk to follow you?
Isorn asked.
Deonoth is right. If Fengbold now knows where we are, it is only a matter of time until Elias brings his full anger to bear on us.
Suspicion may keep these people away from the Stone of Farewell, but it will not keep Earl Guthwulf and the High King's army at bay, said Deonoth.
If the king on the dragonbone chair is going to bring his armies down on us, Joshua replied hotly, throwing his hand up in a gesture of frustration. A few hundred Gadrinset folk will be no more than feathers in a gale against them. That is all the more reason not to drag them in. We few at least can vanish into Aldeorta once more if we must. But these folk cannot.
Again we plan to retreat, Prince Joshua,
Deonoth replied angrily.
You are tired of it yourself. You said as much.
The three were still arguing when the elder returned. They broke off into guilty silence, wondering how much she might have heard. Their conversation, however, was the last thing on her mind.
My cakes! She shrieked, then pulled them off the hot rock, one after the other, making little cries of pain as she burned her fingers.
Each cake was charred black as Priorati's soul.
You monsters! How could you? Talking all your high-flown nonsense about the prince? Then letting my cakes burn!
She turned and smacked ineffectually at Isorn's broad shoulders.
My apologies, good wife, Ealda,
Joshua said, producing another Kinnis piece.
Please, take this and forgive us. Money! She cried even as she took the coin. What about my cakes? Will I give my children money to eat tomorrow morning when they are crying?
She snatched up a broom of bound twigs and swung lustily at Deonoth's head, almost knocking him off the rock on which he sat. He bounded quickly to his feet and joined Joshua and Isorn in full retreat.
Don't come round here any more, she shouted after them. Swords for hire, indeed! Cake burners? The prince is dead, my friend said. And your talk can't bring him back!
Her angry cries slowly faded into the distance as Joshua and his companions stumbled back to their horses and made their way out past the fringes of Gadrinset.
At least, Joshua said after they had walked a while, we have a good idea of where the Stone of Farewell lies.
We learned more than that, Highness, Deonoth said, half smiling. We saw how your name still inspires passion among your subjects. You may be the Prince of Grass, Joshua, Isorn added, but you are definitely not the Prince of Cakes.
Joshua looked at them both disgustedly. I would appreciate, he said slowly, going back to camp in silence. Chapter 22 Through the Summer Gate.
It is not a road that takes us there,
Aditu said sternly.
It is a sort of song.
Simon frowned in irritation. He had asked a simple question, but in her maddening, silly way, Jariki's sister had once more given an answer that was no answer. It was too cold to stand around talking nonsense. He tried again.
If there's no road, it must still be in some direction. What direction is it, then?
Into the forest's heart.
Simon peered up at the sun to try and orient himself. So it's around and around in a circle. When he stopped, the world would continue to reel about him. This dizziness felt much like that, yet calmer. As though the world that spun beneath his feet moved as deliberately as the unfolding petals of a flower. Aditu's wordless, airy drone solidified into a litany of unfamiliar Scythi speech, then trailed off into silent breathing once more. The drab light slipping down through the snowbound trees seemed to have gained some warmer color, an infinitesimal shift of hue that leavened the gray with blue and gold. The silence stretched.
Is this magic?
Simon heard his voice shatter the stillness like the braying of a donkey. He immediately felt foolish. Aditu swung her head to look at him, but her expression showed no anger.
I am not sure what you mean, she said.
It is how we find a hidden place. And Zhao Yi Tonake is indeed hidden. But there is no power in the words themselves. If that is what you ask, they could be spoken in any language. They help the searcher to remember certain signs, certain paths. If that is not what you mean by magic, I am sorry to disappoint you.
She did not look very sorry. Her mischievous smile had come back.
I shouldn't have interrupted,
Simon muttered. I always ask my friend Dr. Morganis to show me magic. He never did. The thought of the old man brought back a memory of a sunny morning in the doctor's dusty chamber, the sound of Morganis mumbling and musing to himself while Simon swept. With that memory came a fierce pang of regret. All those things were gone.
Morganis,
Aditu said musingly.
I saw him once, when he visited my uncle in our lodge. He was a pretty young man.
Young man? Simon stared again at her thin, waif-like face.
Dr. Morganis?
The Scyther suddenly became serious once more.
We should delay no longer. Would you like me to sing the song in your tongue? It could cause no harm. That is worse than the trouble we are already brewing, you and I.
Trouble? Confusion was piling on confusion, but Aditu had taken her odd stance once more. He had a sudden feeling that he must speak quickly, as though a door were being closed.
Yes, please, in my tongue.
She settled on the balls of her feet, poised like a cricket on a branch. After breathing measuredly for a moment, she again began to chant. The song slowly became recognizable, the clumsy, blocky sounds of Simon's westerling speech softening and turning liquid, the words running and flowing together like melting wax.
The serpent's dreaming eye is green, she sang,
her eyes fixed on the icicles that hung like jeweled pennants from the branches of a dying hemlock. The fire absent from the muted sun now burned in their scintillant depths.
His track is moon silver. Only the woman with a net
can see the secret places that he goes.
Aditu's hand drifted out from her side and hung in the air for a long moment before Simon realized that he was expected to take it. He grasped her fingers in his gloved hand, but she pulled free. For a moment he thought he had guessed wrong, that he had forced some unwanted, oafish intimacy on this golden-eyed creature. But as her fingers flexed impatiently, he realized in a rush of confusing feelings that she wanted his bare hand. He pulled his leather mitten off with his teeth, then clasped her slender wrist with fingers warm and moist from their residence in the glove. She gently but firmly pulled her wrist away, this time sliding her hand against his own. Her cool fingers curled around his. With a head shake, like a cat awakened from a nap, she repeated the words she had sung.
The serpent's dreaming eye is green, his track is moon silver. Only the woman with a net can see the secret places that he goes.
Aditu led him forward, ducking beneath the hemlock bough and its burden of icicles. The stiff, snow-salted breeze that clawed at his face brought tears into his eyes. The forest before him was suddenly distorted, as though he were trapped inside one of the icicles, staring out. He heard his boots crunching in the snow, but it seemed to be happening at a great distance, as though his head floated treetop high.
Wind, child, where is an indigo crown?
Aditu crooned. They walked, but it felt more like floating or swimming.
His boots are of rabbit skin. Invisible he is to Moon Mother's stare, but she can hear his cautious breathing.
They turned and clambered down into what should have been a gully lined with evergreens. Instead, to Simon's misted eyes, the tree limbs resembled shadowy arms reaching out to enfold the two travelers. Branches swatted at his thighs as he passed, their scent spicy and strong. Sap-covered needles clung to his breeches. The wind, which breathed whisperingly among the swaying branches, was a little more moist, but still shiveringly cold.
Yellow is the dust on old tortoise's shell.
Aditu paused before a bank of umber stone, which thrust from the snow at the bottom of the gully like the wall of a ruined house. As she stood singing before it, the sunlight that fell through the trees abruptly shifted its angle. The shadows in the crevices of stone deepened, then overtopped their clefts like flooding rivers, sliding across the face of the rock as though the hidden sun were plummeting swiftly toward its evening birth.
He goes in deep places, she chanted. Buried beneath the dry rock, he counts his own heartbeats in chalky shadow.
They curved around the massive stone and suddenly found themselves on a down-slanting bank. Smaller outcroppings of dusky rock, pale pink and sandy brown, pushed up through the snowy ground. The trees that loomed against the sky were a darker green here, and full of quiet birdsong. Winter's bite was noticeably less. They had traveled, but it seemed they had also passed from one kind of day to another, as though they somehow walked at right angles to the normal world, moving unrestrainedly as the angels that Simon had been told flew here and there at God's bidding.
How could that be?
Staring up past the trees into the featureless grey sky, Aditu's hand clutched in his, Simon wondered if he might indeed have died. Might this solemn creature beside him, whose eyes seemed fixed on things he could not see, be escorting his soul to some final destination, while his lifeless body lay somewhere in the forest, slowly vanishing beneath a blanket of drifting snow?
Is it warm in heaven?
He wondered absently. He rubbed at his face with his free hand, and felt the reassuring pain of his chapped skin. In any case, it mattered little. He was going where this one led him. His contented helplessness was such that he felt he could no more remove his hand from hers than remove his head from his body.
Cloud song waves a scarlet torch.
a ruby beneath the grey sea. She smells of cedar bark and wears ivory at her breast.
Aditu's voice rose and fell, her song's slow, thoughtful cadence blending with the bird song, as the waters of one river would meld indistinguishably into the flow of another. Each verse in the endless stream, each cycle of names and colors, was a jeweled puzzle whose solution always seemed to be at Simon's fingertips but never revealed itself. By the time he thought he might be making sense of something, it was gone, and something new was dancing on the forest air. The two travelers passed from the bank of stones into deep shade, entering a thicket of dark green hedges, pearled with tiny white flowers. The foliage was damp, the snow underfoot soggy and unstable. Simon clasped Aditu's hand more firmly. He tried to wipe his eyes, which had blurred again. The little white flowers smelled of wax and cinnamon.
The otter's eye is pebble brown. He slides beneath 10 wet leaves. When he dances in diamond streams, the lantern bearer laughs.
And now, joining with the rising and falling melody of Aditu's song and the delicate trill of birds, came the sound of water splashing in shallow pools, tuneful as a musical instrument made of fragile glass. Shimmering light sparkled on melting snowdrops. As he listened in wonderment, Simon looked all around at the starry gleam of sun through water. The tree branches seemed to be dripping light. They walked beside a small but active stream, whose joyful voice reverberated through the tree-pillared forest halls. Melting snow lay atop the stones, and rich black earth lay beneath the damp leaves. Simon's head was whirling. Aditu's melody ran through all his thoughts, just as the stream slid around and over the polished stones that made its bed. How long had they been walking? It had seemed only a few steps at first, but now it suddenly seemed they had marched for hours, days. And why was the snow vanishing away? Just moments ago, it had covered everything. Spring, he thought, and felt a nervous but exultant laughter bubbling inside him. I think we're walking into spring. They strode on beside the stream. Aditu's music chimed on and on like the water. The sun had vanished. Sunset was blooming in the sky like a rose, singeing all of Aldeota's leaves and branches and trunks with fiery light, touching the stones with crimson. As Simon watched, the blaze flared and died in the sky, then was swiftly supplanted by spreading purple, which itself was devoured in turn by sable darkness. The world seemed to be spinning faster beneath him, but he still felt firmly grounded. One foot followed the other, and Aditu's hand was firm in his.
Stone listener's mantle is black as jet. His rings shine like stars.
As she sang these words, a scattering of white stars indeed appeared against the vault of the heavens. They blossomed and faded in a succession of shifting patterns. Half-realized faces and forms coalesced, pricked in starlight against the blackness, then dissolved again just as rapidly.
9 he wears, but his naked finger lifts and tastes the southerly breeze.
As he walked beneath the velvet black sky and wheeling stars, Simon felt as if an entire lifetime might be passing with incredible swiftness. Simultaneously, the night journey seemed but a single moment of near infinite duration. Time itself seemed to sweep through him, leaving behind a wild mixture of scents and sounds. Aldeota had become a single living thing that changed all around him as the deathly chill melted away and the warmth came pushing through. Even in darkness, he could sense the immense, almost convulsive alterations. As they walked in bright starlight beside the chattering, laughing river, Simon thought he could sense green leaves springing from bare boughs and vibrant flowers forcing their way out of the frozen ground, fragile petals unfurling like the wings of butterflies. The forest seemed to be shaking off winter like a snake shrugging its old, useless skin. Aditu's song wound through everything, like a single golden thread in a tapestry woven of muted colors.
Violet are the shadows in Lynx's ears. He hears the sun rising. His thread sends the cricket to sleep and wakes the white rose.
Morning light began to permeate Aldeorta, spreading evenly, as though it had no single source. The forest seemed alive, every leaf and branch poised, waiting. The air was filled with a thousand sounds and numberless scents, with birdsong and bee drone, the musk of living earth, the sweet rot of toadstools, the dry charm of pollen. Unmuffled by clouds, the sun climbed into a sky that showed purest pale blue between the towering treetops.
"Sky Singer's cape is sparkled in gold,"
Aditu sang triumphantly, and the forest seemed to throb around them as though it had one vast and indivisible pulse.
"His hair is full of nightingale feathers. Every three paces he casts pearls behind, and saffron flowers before him."
She stopped in her tracks and released Simon's hand. His arm fell to his side, limp as a boned fish. Aditu stood on her toes and stretched, lifting her upraised palms to the sun. Her waist was very slender. It took a long time before Simon could speak.
"Are we?"
he tried at last.
"Are we?"
"No, but we have traveled the most difficult part,"
she said, then turned on him with a droll look.
"I thought you would break my hand. You clutched so hard."
Simon remembered her calm, strong grip, and thought how unlikely that was. He smiled dazedly, shaking his head.
"I have never..."
He couldn't make the words come.
"How far have we come?"
She seemed to find this a surprising question, and thought hard for a moment.
"Quite far into the forest,"
she said at last.
"Quite far in."
"Did you make the winter go away by magic?" he asked, turning in a stumbling circle. On all sides the snow was gone. The morning light knifed down through the trees and splashed on the crush of damp leaves underfoot. A spider web quivered, a fire in a column of sunlight.
"The winter has not gone away," she said. "We have gone away from the winter."
"What?"
"The winter you speak of is false, as you know. Here, in the forest's true heart, is a place the storm and cold have not penetrated."
Simon thought he understood what she was saying. "So, you are keeping the winter away by magic?" Aditu frowned.
"That word again. Here the world dances its true dance. That which would change such a truth is magic. Dangerous magic, or so it seems to me."
She turned away, obviously tiring of the subject. There was little of imposture in Aditu's character, at least when it was a matter of her time being wasted in niceties.
"We are almost there now, so there is no need to rest. Are you hungry or thirsty?"
Simon realized that he was ravenous, as if he had not eaten for days. "Yes, both." Without another word, Aditu slipped between the trees and vanished, leaving Simon standing alone by the stream.
"Stay,"
she called, her voice echoing so that it seemed to come from every side at once. A few moments later she reappeared with a reddish sphere, held delicately in each hand.
"Grail,"
she said.
"Sunfruits. Eat them."
The first sunfruit proved sweet and full of yellowy juice, with a spicy aftertaste that made him quickly bite into the second. By the time he had finished both, his hunger was pleasantly blunted.
"Now come,"
she said.
"I would like to reach Shao Irigu by noon today."
"What's Shao Irigu? And what day is it today anyway?" Aditu looked annoyed. If such a mundane expression could be said to exist on so exotic a face.
Shao Iriku is the summer gate, of course. As for the other, I cannot do all the measurements. That is for those like first grandmother. I think you have a moon span. You call Anitul?
Anitul is a month, yes.
That is as much as I can say. It is that month, by your reckoning.
Now it was Simon's turn to be annoyed. He could have told her that much himself, although months did tend to sneak past when one was on the road. What he had been hoping to discover, in a roundabout way, was how long had it taken them to get here. It would have been easy to ask straight out, of course, but somehow he knew that the answer Aditu gave him would not be very satisfying. The Sither woman moved forward. Simon scrambled after her. Despite his irritation, he more than half hoped she would ask for his hand again. But that part of the journey seemed to be over. Aditu picked her way down the slope beside the stream, without looking back to see if he was following. Nearly deafened by the cheerful cacophony of birds in the trees overhead, bewildered by all that had happened, Simon opened his mouth to complain about her evasions, then stopped suddenly in his tracks, shamed by his own short-sightedness. His weariness and crossness abruptly fell away, as though he had sloughed off a heavy blanket of snow, dragged with him out of winter. This was a wild sort of magic, whatever Aditu said. To have been in a deadly storm, a storm that covered all the northern world as far as he could tell, and then to follow a song into sunlight and clear skies. This was as good as anything Simon had ever heard in one of Shem Horsegroom's stories. This was an adventure even Jack Mundwoder never had. Simon the Scullion was going to the kingdom of the fair folk. He hastened after her, chortling. Aditu looked back at him, curiously. As the weather had changed during their strange journey, so too had the vegetation. The evergreens and low shrubs in which Simon had been snowbound and lost had given way to oak and birch and white ash, their interlaced branches bound with flowering creepers, making an overhead canopy colourful as a stained glass ceiling, but far more delicate. Ferns and wood sorrel blanketed the stones and fallen trees, covering Aldeota's floor with a bumpy counterpane of green. Mushrooms crouched hiding in pools of shadow, like deserting soldiers, while other pale but oddly beautiful fungi clung to the trunks of trees like the steps of spiraling staircases. The morning sun sprinkled all with a light like fine silver and gold dust. The stream had cut a gentle gorge in its passage, winding down into a valley whose bottom was obscured by close-leaning trees. As Simon and Aditu picked their way carefully over the slippery rocks that lined the gorge, the stream filled the air around them with fine spray. The watercourse splashed into a series of narrow ponds that grew successively larger down the hillside, each one spilling over into the one below. The ponds were overhung by aspen and drooping willows, the surrounding stones slickly furred in rich green moss. Simon sat down on one to rest his ankles and catch his breath.
"We will be there before too much longer,"
Aditu said, almost kindly.
"I'm fine."
He stretched out his legs before him, staring critically at his cracked boots. Too much snow had ruined the leather, but why should he worry about that now?
"I'm fine," he repeated.
Aditu sat down on the stone beside him and looked up to the skies. There was something quite marvelous about her face, something that he had never seen in her brother, despite the distinct familial resemblance. Turiki had been very interesting to look at, but Simon thought that Aditu was lovely.
"Beautiful," he murmured. "What?"
Aditu turned to look at him questioningly, as though she did not know the word.
"Beautiful," Simon repeated.
"Everything is very beautiful here."
he cursed himself for a coward, and took a deep breath.
"You are beautiful too, lady," he finally added.
Aditu stared at him for a moment, her golden eyes puzzled, her mouth creased in what seemed a tiny frown. Then she abruptly burst into a peal of hissing laughter. Simon felt himself redden.
"Don't look so angry," she laughed again. "You are a very beautiful Snowlock Seoman. I am glad you are happy."
Her swift touch on his hand was like ice on a hot forehead.
"Come," Aditu said. "We will go on now."
The water, uninterested in their doings, continued on its own way, belling and splashing beside them as they made their way down toward the valley. Scrambling over the rocks as he struggled to keep up with light-stepping Aditu, Simon wondered if just this once he might actually have said the right thing. She certainly didn't seem angry at his forwardness. Still, he resolved to continue thinking carefully before he spoke. These Scythi were damnably unpredictable. When they had nearly reached level ground, they stopped before a pair of towering hemlocks, whose trunks seemed vast enough to be the columns upholding heaven. Where these mighty trees thrust up between their smaller neighbors into unshadowed sunshine, tangled nets of flowering creepers grew like an arbor between the two trunks. Trailing blossom-laden vines that hung almost to the ground and quivered in the wind. The grumble of bees was loudest from the flowers. But they swarmed everywhere among the creepers, stolid laborers in gold and black, wings glistening.
"Stop," Aditu said. "Do not so lightly pass through the summer gate."
Despite the power and beauty of the great hemlocks, Simon was surprised. "This is the gate? Two trees?" Aditu looked very serious.
"We left all monuments of stone behind when we fled Aswa, the eastward-looking Seoman. Now, Juriki bade me tell you something before you entered Chao Irigu. My brother said that no matter what may occur later, you have been given the rarest of all honors. You have been brought to a place in which no mortal has ever set foot. Do you understand that? No mortal has ever walked in beneath this gate."
"Oh?" Simon was startled by her words. He looked around quickly, fearing he might see some disapproving audience. But I just wanted someone to help me. I was starving."
"Come,"
she said.
"Juriki will be waiting."
Aditu took a step forward, then turned.
"And do not look so worried," she smiled. "It is a great honor. It is true. But you are Hikastaja, an arrow bearer. Juriki does not break the oldest rules for just anyone."
Simon was passing beneath the great trees before he understood what Aditu had said. "Break the rules?" Aditu was moving quickly now, almost skipping, swift and sure-footed as a deer as she made her way along the path that stretched downhill from the summer gate. The forest here seemed just as wild, but more accommodating. Trees as old and grand as these could never have known the touch of an axe. Yet they stopped just short of the path. Their hanging branches would not brush the head of any but the tallest traveler. They followed this winding path for no little way, traveling on a rise, just a short distance above the floor of the valley. The forest was so thick shrouded with trees on either side of the path that Simon could never see more than a stone's throw before him, and began to feel as though he stood in one place while an endless succession of mossy trunks marched past him. The air had become positively warm. The wild river, which, judging from its noisy voice, snaked a parallel course along the valley floor, not 100 cubits away, filled the forest air with delicate mist. The sleepy hum of bees and other insects washed over Simon like a healthy swallow of Binnebik's hunt liquor. He had almost forgotten himself entirely, and was dreamily following a detour by sheer repetition of left foot, right foot, left foot, when the Sither woman drew him to a halt. To their left, the curtain of trees fell away, revealing the valley floor.
"Turn," she said, suddenly whispering. "Remember, Siomen, you are the first of your kind to see Zhao E Tenukai, the boat on the ocean of trees."
It was nothing like a boat, of course, but Simon understood the name in an instant. Stretched between treetop and ground, and from trunk to trunk and bough to bough, the billowing sheets of cloth, in a thousand diverse colors, resembled at first sight nothing so much as exquisite sails. Indeed, for that first moment, the entire valley floor seemed in truth a vast and incredible ship. Some of these expanses of brilliantly gleaming cloth had been stretched and tented to make roofs. Others twined about the trunks of trees or spanned from bough to ground to form translucent walls. Some simply heaved and snapped in the wind, bound to the highest branches with shiny cords and allowed to wave. The whole city undulated with every shift of the wind, like a seaweed forest on the ocean floor, bowing gracefully with the tide. The cloth and binding cords mirrored with subtle differences the hues of the forest all around, so that in places the additions were barely discernible from that which had grown naturally. In fact, as Simon peered closer, overwhelmed with Zhao E Tenukai's subtle and fragile beauty, he saw that in many places the forest and city appeared to have truly been shaped as one, so that they blended together with unearthly harmony. The river which meandered along the center of the valley floor was more subdued here, but still full of relentless, ringing music. The rippling light it reflected onto the city's shifting facades added to the illusion of watery depth. Simon thought he could also see the silvery tracks of other streams weaving in and out through the trees. The forest floor between the houses, if such they were, was covered with thick greenery, mostly springy clover. This grew like a carpet everywhere, but on the paths of dark earth that had been lined with shimmering white stone. A few of the gracefully haphazard bridges that spanned the waterway were also constructed of this same stone. Beside these paths, strange birds with fan-like, iridescent tails of green and blue and yellow strutted or flapped unsteadily back and forth between earth and the lowest branches of the surrounding trees, all the while uttering harsh and somewhat foolish-sounding cries. There were other flashes of incandescent color among the upper branches, birds as brilliantly feathered as the fantails, but considerably more mellifluous of voice. Warm, gentle winds lifted an essence of spices and tree sap and summer grass to Simon's nose. The avian choir fluted a thousand different songs that somehow fit together like a terrifyingly beautiful puzzle. The marvelous city stretched away before him into the sunlit forest, a heaven more welcoming than any he had ever envisioned.
"It's wonderful," Simon breathed.
"Come," Aditu said. "Jeriki awaits you in his house."
She beckoned. When he didn't move, she gently took his hand and led him. Simon stared around in delight and awe as they followed a cross trail down off the rise and onto the outermost path of the valley floor. The rustling of silken folds and the murmuring river blended their melodies together beneath the birdsong, creating a new sound that was altogether different, but still infinitely satisfying. There was a long time of looking, smelling, and listening before Simon even began thinking once more.
"Where is everyone?" he asked at last.
In all of the city within his sight, a space easily twice the size of Battle Square, back in Urchester, he could not see a single living soul.
"We are
A solitary folk, Siomen,
Aditu said.
We stay largely to ourselves, except at certain times. Also, it is midday now, when many of our people like to leave the city and go out walking. I am surprised. We saw no one near the pools.
Despite her reasonable words, Simon thought he sensed something troubling the Sither. As though she herself was not quite sure she spoke the truth. But he had no way of knowing. Expressions or behaviors that meant something definite among those with whom Simon had grown up were almost useless as standards by which to judge any of the Sither he had met. Nevertheless, he felt fairly sure that something was troubling his guide, and that it might very well be the emptiness Simon had noticed. A large wildcat strode imperiously onto the pathway before them. For a startled moment, Simon felt his heart speed to a frenzied pace. Despite the creature's size, Aditu did not break stride, walking toward it as calmly as if it were not there. With a flip of its stubby tail, the wildcat abruptly bounded away and vanished into the undergrowth, leaving only the bouncing fronds of fern to show it had existed at all. Clearly, Simon realized, birds were not the only creatures who roamed unhindered through Zhao E Tenokai. Beside the path, the coats of foxes, seldom seen at night, let alone bright noon, glimmered like flames in the tangled brush. Hares and squirrels stared incuriously at the pair as they passed. Simon felt quite sure that if he leaned down toward any of them, they would move unhurriedly out of his fumbling reach, discommoded for a moment, but utterly unafraid. They crossed a bridge over one of the river forks, then turned and followed the watercourse down a long corridor of willows. A ribbon of white cloth wound in and out among the trees on their left, wrapped about trunks and looped over branches. As they passed farther down the row of willow sentries, the initial ribbon was joined by another. These two snaked in and out, crossing behind and before each other, as though engaged in a kind of static dance. Soon more white ribbons of different widths began to appear, woven into the growing pattern in knots of fantastic intricacy. These weavings at first made up only simple forms, but soon Simon and Aditu began to pass increasingly complex pictures that hung in the spaces framed by the willow trunks,